everybody. Welcome back to the Overrun Podcast. My name is Ed Bowder.
I'm Dan Schwester.
I'm Kevin Mazza.
I'm Anna Ryan.
And today we are going to talk about naloxone, Narcan administration. And as luck would have it, we have an explicit tag on Apple Podcasts and on all the other venues. So I'm going
Probably
to start.
Probably a good idea.
So I'm going to start this podcast by saying that the way that we treat opiate overdoses is fucking bananas. And we're going to go on from there. So a couple of weeks ago at this point, Anna Ryan, the contributor to The Overrun, put out an article on Narcan, and it was essentially the Band-Aid that no one knows how to use. And got a lot of attention, got a lot of audience, and we want to kind of dovetail
off
of that.
Nice job, Anna.
Very good. Yay, Anna.
All right.
So essentially, the way that we treat opioid overdoses in EMS, and I would say in healthcare in general, is atrocious. We're not very good at it, and we have sort of a limited understanding about how naloxone works. So from the start, I'm going to turn it over to Anna because I want to hear what she has to say about Narcan, since she is the author of the blog post, which will be linked in the show notes. Get them.
Hooray. So what I referenced in the article a few times is that the distribution of Narcan to people who are untrained is half of our problem. So we have, you know, police officers, we have, you know, and I'm going to say it, I'm going to go ahead with EMS, BLS, who are kind of handed an overdose kit and said, good luck. And we've done all this without actually training anybody in what the drug does, why we use it, or how to assess a patient for an opiate overdose in the first place. So, that's
so is it any wonder it doesn't work right?
No, because I don't think that.
No, because no one knows how to. Fucking
no one
get
knows
it.
What we're doing. That's a fucking problem. Is that at one point or another, you have to have the training in order to understand what we're putting drugs into other people's bodies, and it's just as for what? Because they're asleep? Because they look like they may be sicker than they actually are? Like this is we have no reasoning behind it.
But we've been told that Narcan is the cure for opioid overdoses.
Right, and I'll take your cure and show you all of the pulmonary edema that comes out from those admins and the organ failure and the, you know, the how many injuries do we have to sustain as an EMS profession because someone reversed a heroin overdose and there happened to be a whole bunch of cocaine underneath it?
Right. And recently we know that about 3%, at least the data supports, about 3% of people that receive Narcan, especially high-dose Narcan, and we want to talk about the way that we administer it, experience things like pulmonary edema, end-stage organ failure, and ultimately death. Now, the argument is made that without the Narcan, they may have died anyway, from hypoxia or anoxia, which may be true. For me, the central component to this was initially when the Narcan. Now, again, we have a much different perspective, I would argue, in our area. We are in the Atlantic Northeast. There is a very specific type of rollout, the way that Narcan was given. This is certainly not a holistic approach. This is just kind of us explaining a problem with a system that we see that we're trying to address. So initially, when Narcan was released in our area, it was given in 2 milligram and 2 ml Bristojets with a mucosal atomizer device so it could be distributed equally among the nasal turbinates, blah, blah, blah. Then a manufacturer, and I'm not judging the manufacturer, this is actually probably a brilliant marketing scheme, they put 4 milligrams and 0.1 ml that are administered just with a simple button push, so they effectively idiot-proofed the Narcan administration procedure. This is where a lot of law enforcement officials got involved because now they have this very easy to administer drug. Now they give the naloxone to people that they find are candidates for the drug or candidates for opiate overdoses. They give it. Where the education problem comes in is no one bothered to tell them that it can take 15 minutes for naloxone to work if you give intranasally. So they give 4 milligrams, and then 5 minutes later, they give another 4 milligrams.
Not even 5 minutes. We're looking at shorter sure. administration times than that. And that's where we're coming into most of the problem.
Right. And they managed to not bag somebody in the interim. Now, we have our own problems with bagging. We know that there's an issue with that, but they don't give them any oxygen at all. It's a lot of give the Narcan and wait, and then nothing
and
happens.
Then
give it again.
And then give more. And what ends up happening is we get these patients who end up being very, very sick from it. So just as a refresher to those that are listening, we know the way that naloxone works. It's a competitive inhibitor. It binds to the mu receptors with a higher affinity than opiates do, and that's why it works. Now, because the drug works that way, it is not an antidote. An antidote is a word that has a definition, and that's not it. So something like activated charcoal would be a better example of an antidote. But the way that it's been taught, I think, to a lot of people is that, you know what? It's an antidote. Go ahead. They're suspected opiate overdose. Take the Narcan. It's an antidote.
It
that's
is a
not
magic
how it works.
Potion.
Right. But
solves
that, but that's,
all our problems.
And that's kind of how we taught it, is that it's this magic drug that just fixes everything, and it is not either of those things. It is a drug that has side effects. So one of the things, and as EMS providers that we're concerned about, is we worry about safety. Now, generally speaking, I've only encountered one or two really truly hostile patients after they've received Narcan, but it is a problem systemically where we see people who receive Narcan, and a lot of times now, part of the problem is that the heroin that patients are taking is not heroin. It's oftentimes just straight fentanyl at this point. And there's also a lot of polypharmaceutical things that you have to be concerned about. Do they have a stimulant underneath? So recently in our area, there was a couple of EMTs who were assaulted in the back of their ambulance after giving Narcan because now they had a patient who was high on a stimulant.
Right. And that's something that we want to, that you need to understand about the background of this is that, you know, if you're doing heroin, you're probably doing other things too.
Probably.
A lot of people, a lot of, you know, addictive behaviors and things like that. And, you know, heroin comes after you've been partying for 2 days and you really need to get some sleep. And, you know, the heroin tends to mask what they're taking underneath. So when we bind that receptor, we block that effect. What are we getting underneath? And we don't really know that when we respond to that unconscious person. So we give Narcan, it doesn't work right away. We give more. And now all of a sudden they've got a, you know, over clinical level of, you know, Narcan. And now they're awake and now they're hypertensive and they're tachycardic and they're agitated. And, you know, of course, we're, you know, the first response is generally this is when somebody, some well-meaning individual will say, hey, why don't you calm down? And not realizing that.
Because the best way to get someone to calm down is to tell them to calm down.
And when they don't listen to you, make sure you get in their face and saying in a really loud voice.
Or
because that
them.
Helps things.
Threaten
too.
Them that they're going to go to jail.
You could do that too.
Or throw in their face that they were almost dead.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Remind them.
Yeah. Remind them repeatedly that you've saved their life and they ought to be thankful. These things tend to not end up well in our experience. We're joking around about this, but we've all seen this happen. We tend to live where we work and we are at the epicenter of the opioid epidemic.
But again, it's. I think we joke about it because it's either laugh or scream.
Yeah, yeah. It's frustration. We have to laugh because, you know, it really is screaming. We're not doing a good job with this. We're not doing a good job with educating people. And you know, and Anna, you know, I mean, we've all seen this, you know, the respiration rate of 20, you know, gets Narcan because they're unconscious.
Right.
You know, the cardiac arrest. Well, we give them Narcan. Why?
So, and again, I think it's important to remind people, like, the whole reason to give Narcan in the presence of an opiate overdose is to get them to start breathing adequately. It's not even getting them to breathe 20 times a minute. I don't care about that. Like,
correct.
12 is perfectly fine. 6 is perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm. Like, how about oxygenating to a point where they have a decent SpO2
right.
with a minimum amount of assistance and they can manage their secretions so I don't have to put a tube in?
Manage my secretions, by the way, it sounds like a metal band and it makes me it makes me smile whenever I hear it. But that's the thing, like, you know, that's why I kind of like the IV Narcan, because you give 0.4, 0.8, and then they can start breathing, and then, you know, you send them to the hospital, they'll sleep it off and be on their way. Where, you know, you give the 8, 12 milligram, you know, things, now we're moving into a whole other avenue where you have people who can be very sick, sicker than they would have been, incidentally, after the overdose, and, you know, we make them worse, which, again, is contrary to the whole point. Mm-hmm. You know, and so from a training standpoint, Anna, how do you think we can better train EMTs to give Narcan? Or is it more that we should just train them to, you know, look at respiratory patterns and then consider Narcan as part of their armament?
So I think that Narcan is important in as like an end game. So if we're teaching EMTs to assess for poisoning, essentially, but for an opiate overdose, why we're not teaching airway as like the absolute start to a treatment, I'm not particularly sure. I did look at the Narcan video. It's up on YouTube. You can search it, just Narcan instructional, whatever. And it is one of those things where we are showing this kind of instruction to providers without actually giving them any provider information. This is something that's geared toward the general public. We don't have anything that counts for respirations or breathing. There's no examination of pupils. There's no different routes that a patient can take the drug. Anything to be taken into consideration is just, here's a thing, give it as fast as you can, and hopefully everything will be better. The problem is that at the end of that video, it says call 911, and we are 911. So we're leaving people in the lurch as to what it is that we can manage, what we can't manage. Once you give Narcan, you can't take it back.
Right.
So if you're going to manage an airway and give Narcan, that's probably fine. But we're also teaching them that being high, essentially, is bad, is the wrong thing to do. Like, yeah, from the DARE perspective, sure, you don't want to be, you know, involved with in the heroin game. Like, that's what it is. But, like, if you have someone who is no longer breathing well and you make them breathe better, but they're still high, okay. Why isn't that acceptable?
And it's already panned out in the data that, you know, education programs like DARE don't work effectively well. But as a culture, as a society, we are very, very bad at how we address people that have opiate addiction. Like, we know that addiction is something that's in the DSM-5. We know that it's an actual psychological disorder. And here's the thing that drives me nuts. When we have a patient or a provider who will say things like, well, you know what? They didn't have to take the heroin. Like, okay, you're right. They didn't. But then they did.
Yeah.
So who cares?
I ate all the bacon and eggs that you had, but I did that too.
Right.
These are things that really boil my blood.
Can we just all agree right off the bat and just make this as a rule of EMS? The first day you get in, could you just stop making value judgments? You are not making anything better.
Yeah.
Judging your patients, look, they're gonna do dumb things.
That's why we're there. We literally exist
for the person who overdosed on heroin. We exist for the person who tried to jump their ATV over the car. We're there for the person who went van surfing because they saw Teen Wolf one time. Stop judging these people.
It's a good reference.
They're not going to make any better decisions. Right. We're there to pick up the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think a big problem is we don't look at addiction patients the same way we look at even something diabetic, any other patient that we will see frequently, the same patient multiple times over and over. And, you know, do we get really that upset at diabetic that we see once a week? Yeah, maybe a little annoyed, but you don't treat them any differently. You don't be like, you know, hey, Mr. Smith, you got to eat before you go to bed. I'm sick of coming here at 3 a.m. We have to stop stigmatizing the addicted, and you should treat the patient the same way every time, even if it's the same time you see them in 24 hours for the same problem, because you're not waking them up and yelling at them. It doesn't work. Tough love, doesn't work. And I've had people close to me who have suffered addiction, and I've seen tough love pan out and only push them further into the hole.
Right. It doesn't make things any better.
No, it only forces them to self-medicate further. And, and social media is alive with people be like, just let them fucking die. Fuck them. They're junkies. Right.
And which you're a healthcare provider.
I didn't even get there. This is healthcare providers. I do not miss a beat when I challenge those people because, do you go to your MI patients and be like, hey man, you shouldn't have been eating all those cheeseburgers. Keep the burgers out of your mouth.
That's a perfect analogy. We don't, the way that we feel about addicts is, again, like, you know, you didn't have to take the heroin in the first place, which most of the time, especially in patients from like the ages of 40 to 55, they didn't take heroin the first time. They were given Oxycontin for back pain.
Or they were given Percocet or they were given Vicodin.
Right. Yeah.
And they lost their job and they lost their health insurance. And now they
can't manage
their pain.
Heroin's cheaper than trying to get Vicodin. Like that's correct. Just the reality. Again, it's an economic problem.
$5 a bag, gang.
Yeah, we don't talk to our COPD patients who we've seen for the third time in a week for an asthma attack because they smoked for 40 years. We don't talk to our MI patients who are 350 pounds and have been throwing down, you know, terrible diet. Like, they've had a terrible diet for years. We don't address those people the same way. And it's because it's a long-term, it's because it's more of a long-term thing. We don't have that tangible thing. We're like, well, I don't see their rig, so I can't say like, well, maybe you shouldn't be eating McDonald's. Like,
but we have to stop. We have to stop treating people with any mental illness. Just forget addiction alone. Telling somebody to go for a walk who has depression, they have a chemical imbalance in their brain. They need possible medication. They need cognitive therapy. They need a whole slew of things other than putting on some good running shoes and throwing on their headphones and going for a run.
Just shake it off.
And as,
you'll be fine.
As a point of order, like we are going to have an episode that it's going to be fairly deep a little bit later. And we're going to get into PTSD and depression. But like, you know, just as a quick note, it's not a thing that we talk about like, you know what, suck it off, walk it off. Like, it doesn't help things. It's the same thing like when you treat someone who has overdosed on heroin, saying like, you have to go to rehab. Well, first of all, no shit. And secondly, yelling at them is going to help things. Like, that doesn't work. We're in a system now. So we are lucky enough to broadcast from the great state of New Jersey. And
our secret's out.
So what ended up happening is there was an edict that came out where essentially by law, patients that overdose or are given Narcan have to go to the hospital. The problem with this is that if someone has received Narcan and they're alert and oriented and can answer questions, they still have to go to the hospital, even if they don't want to. So now we're in a system where, you know what? Kidnap somebody. Go for it. It's just kind of like how we have to do it.
Oh,
and we're also not the only state that has things like this. So I'm not trying to throw the state of New Jersey under the bus. I've lived here my whole life.
The road to hell paved with good intentions. And this is one of the things where I really did believe, you know, the state was trying to do a good thing, and we're taking New Jersey as an example, but this could be your state. This could be Massachusetts. This could be anywhere where
this could be your town.
People were dying. I mean, people were dropping like flies, and we all worked through this, you know, in our own shops. We were dealing with this, you know, we were going on overdose after overdose after overdose. We were pronouncing, you know, people like 19, 20, 21 who just nobody got to them in time. Something had to be done. So, you know, the idea that, you know, this is a solution, you know, we could give them this medication. We could wake people up. We could keep them from dying. It sounded like a good idea. Who were the best people to give it to? Police officers. You know why? Because they're on scene. They're in the neighborhood. They're around. You can get to them before.
They're usually there first.
You could get there before, you know, anybody else and do this and save people's lives. And, you know, this was a thing that, you know, the oversight group that looks over new police officers said, okay, well, it seems logical that if you give them this medication and they've had an overdose, they need to go to the hospital. You must take them to the hospital. Sounds good. I'm a police, you know, you're a police officer. You have handcuffs. You have a car with a cage in the back. You can take somebody to the hospital. You can take somebody against their will. That's part of the job. But one of the curveball to the problem, Ed, was when we signed a good law that was signed by Governor Christie back in the day. And, you know, say what you want. And, you know, he didn't come out too popular at the end. But, you know, this was probably one of the better decisions he made. And honestly, I think he's going to be recognized for actually looking at this as a public health issue as opposed to just a strict law enforcement problem. So for a politician, I give him all the credit in the world for it. And he basically said, if you call 911 on an overdose, nobody at that scene can get arrested for possession, use, possession of drug paraphernalia, anything like that. The idea was just to get that person the help they needed to save their life. And that was a great thing. But it caused a conundrum. Because now you have a police officer that must take somebody to the hospital, but he has no legal basis to take them to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And here comes EMS. We know that if somebody's A&O times three, they could be bleeding to death. They could be having a heart attack. And we've all had these instances, or we know of an instance where somebody we knew had to go to the hospital said no. I don't want to go to the hospital.
And that's it. You're capable of making your own bad decisions.
Correct. That's a fundamental tenet of our democracy is right. That, yes, you're allowed to make stupid decisions.
Yeah, it happens all the time. So, and one of the other thing that in this particular instance was EMS was not consulted at all. This was a law enforcement decision.
This was a law enforcement issue, and nobody talked to anybody in EMS.
Right. It's not necessarily a criticism just of the police. But at no point was someone like, so how would this affect EMS, do you think? And it was never brought up. So what ends up happening is we end up treating somebody like, no, if they don't want to go to the hospital, I can't make them go. And the cops will give ultimatums like, well, you're either going to go with them or you're going to come with me.
Uh-oh.
And that, like, who in their right mind is going to go, I'd much rather go in the police car.
Yeah.
I hear their seats exactly. Are very comfortable.
A lot of leg room. Like vomit at all.
Yeah, stretch out a little bit.
Yeah, lay out.
Right. And the biggest problem and the big issue with this is that nobody looked at the science. OK, mm-hmm. there is published studies out there that indicate that somebody can that if you give somebody Narcan, you wake them up. The vast majority of them will not re-overdose. It doesn't happen.
Right. And physiologically, it doesn't make sense either. The half-life of heroin is about 6 minutes. The half-life of Narcan can be up to 90. So physiologically, it doesn't make sense. If someone now, and again, this is if someone took heroin, if they take fentanyl, if they took carfentanil, their half-life is a little bit different. But it doesn't make sense that if someone took heroin and then they take Narcan that they'll relapse.
Right.
And I think a lot of times, you know, anecdotally, we'll have people just be like, well, I've treated the same person three or four times in the same night. First of all, it was probably an outlier. And second,
They probably just did heroin again.
Yeah.
They probably just went out and got more.
Yeah, like this, it's just, you just did it. Like, it's,
and that's,
you know,
what the studies, there was two major studies. 2003, it was Vilke et al. They looked at 1,000 patients, and they had zero deaths in a 12-hour period.
Zero.
Following,
zero following an RMA.
The RMA.
None.
There was another study in 2011, Wampler et al., and they basically got the same results. There wasn't anything there. There were a couple deaths in some of these, I think in the Wampler study, there actually was a couple deaths, but one person, I believe, got hit by a car, and one went out and got more drugs, but they couldn't, that was a second overdose. it's generally safe.
And this is getting back to the education thing where we teach, and I think we tend to teach EMTs this more than medics, like, well, you never know.
Yeah,
And what if they stop breathing? Like, right, but they won't.
Right, and if they stop breathing, it's not like you can't fix it.
Well, what if we said this about diabetics?
Well, here's the thing, too, is that if we said this about...
Oh, you got a hypoglycemic, blood sugar's 20, we give them D10 or D50 or whatever you're using, wake them up, and we said, well, you might get hypoglycemic again. We don't do that. Why would we do it with this?
Well, I don't have an answer.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, it's we have this very weird stigma that tends to be tied into specifically opiate addiction. And again, you know, we look at certain lifestyle decisions that are not opiate addiction. And I mean, I don't mean to say we have no problem with it. I mean, you know, we've all had that lift assist. We're like, oh man, like, could you not be 700 pounds? Like, We've all had that.
Stay in bed, but, Gertrude. Just leave it.
Right, exactly. Like, we've all had those injuries. But, again, they are few and far between. Here, you know, now we're at a point where we're treating, you know, opiate overdoses daily. You know, and it's a fairly common occurrence. But we do not treat it the same way that we treat other chronic illnesses.
We don't even talk to these patients the same way.
No, absolutely not. No. And that's the thing that needs to be addressed. So, I guess since the whole point of what we're trying to do is we're trying to change... or adjust culture a little bit in how do we better address an opiate overdose? Let's say we give them Narcan, we wake them up, which is not the goal, right? But let's say we wake them up. What's a better way to address them than just like staring them down, be like, you have to go to the hospital, and like threatening them?
Well, first and foremost, it's got to be a calm environment. If you got to clear people out of the room, clear them out of the room, and then talk to them gently as they come around because they're confused. They're not going to know where they are. Just like waking up a diabetic, they don't know what was going on while they were out. Talk to them calmly. Let them know what you did. You can ask them how much they took if they're willing to admit it. If not, doesn't matter.
And don't harp. My thing is, and don't harp on that either.
Oh, God, no.
Like, the whole thing of, like, well, how much heroin did you take? Because the reality exists, too.
Where are you getting your stuff?
Right.
Oh. Who cares?
Or, like, the reality exists, too.
I've had EMTs try to grill people about, where'd you get it? What's his name? Tell the police. It's like, whoa. You need to step outside of this room right now.
Who cares?
You're done here. This is not
your
job.
Hey, Sonny Crockett. Put it back.
But also, like, and it's entirely possible that, again, we assume that the patient took heroin, but there's other opiates out there.
Yeah.
There are chronic pain patients who might be taking morphine, they might be taking Percocet, and they just took one too many. And the other thing, too, is people who are addicts are taking whatever drug they're taking to self-medicate. That is, at a functional level, what they're doing. And because there's no control over heroin, it's entirely possible that the patients who usually get heroin are no longer getting heroin. So the comparison I've always made, where imagine if you were drinking Miller Lite your entire life. First of all, I'm a little bit sad for you because I am a beer snob.
Why would you?
But if you were drinking Miller Lite your entire life, right? And whatever, 5.4% alcohol by volume, whatever it is. And someone made an Everclear that had the same look, taste, consistency as Miller Lite, and they put it in a Miller Lite can. Would you change your drinking habits? And you probably wouldn't.
Yes.
But, you know, like, you probably wouldn't, right? It has the same thing, but it's much more potent, which is the analogy to fentanyl to heroin. So it's not like people overdose. And the other thing, too, is people don't overdose on purpose. Like,
no.
Generally speaking.
Rarely.
Generally speaking. There is, of course, there's a cohort that does, and that's a whole different, that's more of a suicide aspect that we're talking about differently. But rare is that people are like, guess what I'm going to do today?
Today's the day.
Like, that's a very rare occurrence where, like, if someone takes two bags daily and they're just taking their standard two bags, no one, like, is like, well.
No, they're just trying to keep from getting sick.
Right.
Yeah, or being in pain.
Or being in pain.
Which is something that I think is very ill-addressed in our industry, is like dope sick is very sick.
Yeah.
Like coming down and withdrawing off of opiates is horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend that people watch Trainspotting if they haven't seen it. There's actually a scene in Trainspotting where they show someone going through opiate withdrawal. That's fairly accurate. For those who have not gone through opiate withdrawal, I shouldn't talk like I know what I'm talking about. But like my understanding is that it's actually fairly accurate to what people experience.
It can't be pleasant.
We see it in the people that we wake up.
Yeah, you can put them in.
There hasn't been a single person that has gotten Narcan in the back of my ambulance or in their living room who hasn't looked at me and been like, "I feel like death. I'm going to throw up. I'm probably going to lose my bowels, all of it. Like, it's a nightmare.
Well, and also the people that are recovering after we give them Narcan, like, if they're mean, they're not doing it to be a dick to you.
Yeah. We have to stop taking that personally, too. We're taking a lot of this personally.
Yeah. And that's it. We have this kind of ethos where, like, I saved your life.
Yeah.
Like, you should be thankful and grateful for it.
Take and your hero cape off. This is not what you're here for.
Right. It's patient care. That's the whole point.
Oh, I mean, listen, EMS in general, you gotta check your ego at the door for every single thing you do. But,
and that's not to say that any one of us hasn't had that happen, like where we like walk into a scene, we really turn someone around, and we're like, we are gods among men.
Feeling good and acting that way are two completely different things.
Right.
Like, right.
I sleep well from the job I do because I feel good doing it.
Right.
I don't feel good talking down to people. I don't feel good talking down to diabetics,
right.
cardiac patients, cancer patients, and overdose patients. It doesn't make me feel good. I wouldn't want, and like I said, it's coming from somebody who knows someone who's personally affected by drug addiction.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched the way my parents have talked to this person. I've watched the way that their friends have talked to this person. I've seen the way that, thought about the way I've talked to this person. And it's like really like it's kind of disgusting, and tough love, be it from a stranger, from a family member, from your best friend or your spouse, it doesn't work. And us getting on scene and pulling up our pants and rolling up our sleeves and being like, "Oh, you need to fix this, or else I'm going to be back here, and you know, next time, and maybe you won't be so lucky." Like, that doesn't feel good. It's bad enough they're getting dope sick right in front of you on the table, you know, right. on your stretcher, and then lecturing them like. That's not your place. Your job is to get there and to address their respiratory issue and then bring them to the hospital and relatively intact, where you don't have an airway compromise from vomiting or you don't have poop all over your stretcher. Like,
yeah, that'd be you're, nice. Yeah.
But again, even if you do, okay, that's...
Well, here's the other question I have is that at one point or another, as providers, we're supposed to be trained to think about the end game.
Right.
So if I'm treating a diabetic, you know, once I wake them up and I feed them a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, there's going to be a time where I look at them and say, "Listen, I've been here 3 or 4 times this month. Why don't you talk to your doctor about an insulin pump, or, you know, we should talk about your diet or whatever it is." At one point or another, that person has to be managed past our care. So why aren't we talking to the people that unfortunately are woken up about, "Listen, there is help available. We can do this with you. We can take you to a place where you can be assisted, and there's no judgment here either."
And there are some programs in place in some hospitals where they'll actually have people in the hospital sit with the patient and talk about like going to rehabs. But again, the issue with that, and while I'm supportive of programs like that, the issue with that is that you cannot compel someone to go into rehab.
No.
That has to be a decision that's made, you know, through a lot of steps with that particular patient.
It's the exact same thing as somebody who's newly diagnosed with leukemia. You can't force them to go to leukemia. You can't force them to go through chemo and radiation.
Right.
You have, just like any person here, you have to take your health in your own hands. It's a little tougher for an addict with a different mindset, but in the same way, people who have heart problems, like, "Oh, no, I'm not going to go to a stress test. I'm not going to see a doctor. I'm just going to keep living how I'm living." Yeah. And that's applicable through every single patient we encounter. You have to take your health in your own hands, and the best thing we can do for these patients is encourage them to talk to somebody, encourage them to, you know, speak to a social worker at the hospital.
Right.
There's only so much we can do care-wise, but we should do our best to encourage them to keep going on their own.
This is also where our education falls short, like drastically short, is that we are teaching people to see patients and not people. So at one point or another, if you woke up in a stupor, would you want some stranger standing over you telling you that you were wrong for doing something?
Right.
Exactly. If you can't interpret that for yourself, then maybe you're not in the right job.
Yeah, and just to touch on Kevin's point with the leukemia, like I had lymphoma twice when I was younger, and the second time when I relapsed, there was a significant portion of time where I was like, "I'm not doing that again," and I can understand at a visceral level, especially if someone's been through rehab before, where like you have to go through it. You're like, I'm not doing that. Like that is, that's a, to say that that's a difficult decision to make is the grossest understatement of the year, you know, and it's not, and forcing someone to be like, guess what you get to do? I'm going to lock you away for 28 to 60 days. You're not going to see your family or your friends, and you're going to be super sick.
I mean, you're talking about that. Imagine it's hard enough just getting like myself to go to the gym and get on a damn treadmill.
to be fair, running on a treadmill sucks.
It's
elliptical's not better.
Yeah, chemo's a walk in the park, right?
I just kind of laid there most of the time. It wasn't really.
I'm so glad you can laugh about that.
Just a little perspective. If you go to, and we'll put this in the show notes, emupdates.com. Ruben Strayer is an EM physician in New York City, and he's really been one of the leaders in talking about opioid prescribing in the emergent setting, and also managing people with opioid misuse problems. And he's not calling it addiction; he calls it misuse. And he lays the blame. He's got a slide set on there. If you get a chance to look at it, it's really illuminating. You know, we created this problem. We're in the midst of an opioid epidemic nationwide, and we created the problem. Medicine created the problem. They told you that, you know, we told people that opioids for pain wasn't addictive and that it was self-limiting and people would be fine and that there wouldn't be dependence issues.
The reason that heroin is called heroin was because Bayer marketed it as a heroic drug. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. that was the whole point, ironically, to get people off of morphine addiction. The whole point of the whole point of heroin was that it was supposed to be the greatest thing that ever happened. Like, that was the whole point when Bayer put it out in the early 20th century.
Right. And it's important to say that we're not talking about, you know, opioid use in acute trauma or right at the beginning or at the end of life, you know, at the end of life here, because that's where these things need to be used.
Sure.
You know, don't hold back. If you go on a call tomorrow and you've got a burn patient with 40 to 50% second degree and some third,
give them the fentanyl.
Yeah. And then give them the dose of fentanyl. And if it's not working, give them ketamine.
Yeah.
You know, use whatever you have in your toolbox. That's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about that MI patient that is refractory to nitroglycerin and needs fentanyl. We're not talking about that cancer patient at the end of their life that needs palliative care or hospice care. Not the same thing.
And it's important to note, too, that the amount of people that will actually develop a chronic addiction secondary to an acute treatment is remarkably small. So if you're a provider and you're worried that giving morphine or giving fentanyl is going to cause someone to suddenly have you know, a significant addiction, from our end, that's just not a thing that happens all that frequently.
No.
Not to say that it doesn't, but it does not happen frequently. Where you run into those type of issues is when you have someone who has a chronic condition and they're given an opiate prescription. But if you have someone who fractures their femur and you give them fentanyl, they're not going to wake up in the trauma department suddenly addicted to heroin.
I think it's something we have to kind of convey to our patients, too. I've had patients look at me and say, I'll deal with the pain because I don't want to be addicted to fentanyl at the end of this. Like,
okay,
bro, for your amputated fingers, you can have some fentanyl and be fine.
Right.
And that's where we need to think about is it, you know, that generally in the acute setting, we're still using these things and they're important modalities.
Right.
Yep. And you have to respect, too, if you have someone who has a history of opiate addiction and they prefer not to receive fentanyl or morphine.
Yeah, the algorithm doesn't apply.
Like, that's also perfectly fine.
Right.
Like, I completely understand that. I think that you would benefit from this, you know, and maybe even something like ketamine would work for them. Mm-hmm. But I get it. And it's something that we have to kind of think about as well. You know, it's not, as an industry, it's something that we've, I don't want to say that we failed at it, but we're getting pretty damn close to having failed at how we actually treat these patients.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, this is something that we do. I mean, you know, conversely, the other thing I see providers at times, and I've heard clinicians, well, I'm not giving pain management to this patient because they're seeking.
Oh my God, that drives me nuts.
They're seeking. Yeah, it's like
you don't get a bonus at the end of your shift for keeping your fentanyl.
I just
give it.
I've seen this on the street level provider. I walked into one of our posts one day during shift change and walked up and saw on a whiteboard an address was written and it says drug seeker. And I promptly lost my little dog mind and went right into a social media forum where most of our providers are, and I lambasted whoever did it, and I don't care. I immediately erased it and proceeded to tell people why they shouldn't feel that way. Of course, they're going to feel whatever way they want, but well, you have set that person up for a problem. You are going to get called to that address at some point. They're going to be claiming to be in pain. It's not your job to decide whether or not to give them pain medication because another crew wrote up on the board, another person's just looking for drugs.
And that goes to a bigger problem. That's a HIPAA violation.
That was a
huge problem.
That
that's
should,
a,
I mean, that should
this
go
is, that
saying.
Is an ethical pit that nobody
yeah,
wants to get into.
I,
Sarlacc.
But that's like, that's, and again, I'm sure that that's something that was written up, you know, on the post wall as, you know, in a moment of frustration, moment of anger.
Oh,
whatever.
I can almost guarantee it. But that right. Our job is to walk into the most chaotic situations and keep our cool. If you can't walk in like during your day to day and not be frustrated and be so frustrated that you have to put that kind of sensitive information
right.
and judgment up on a board. So next crew coming on is going to hear that address go out. They're going to go there with a preconceived notion of how they're going to
sure.
treat that patient.
And
you
make
have,
a value judgment.
You have,
we shouldn't be doing that with
you
patients.
Have already,
have no placement in
you have already
contact.
Failed that patient before
right.
you walked out the door. As soon as you found that address, you saw that, you read it, you failed that patient.
And there's an there's also a possibility that you're wrong.
Yeah.
Like what if the patient actually has like a chronic pain disorder and you were just really grumpy because you didn't sleep? Like there's a way that you can treat people, and it's it's do your job. You know,
yeah.
that's
is
kind
it
of the big
possible
thing.
That somebody with an addiction or a misuse problem could have a pathology that's causing severe pain?
A
well,
lot
that's
of
it's,
the people with abuse problems started that
right.
way.
It's,
that's
it's
why
not,
they're
it's
there.
Not, it's like is that it, you know? It's not even a possibility. It's a probability at this point.
Sure.
You know, like that's kind of the thing. But so we don't. This is not something that we do terribly well in our industry, and it's something that we have to kind of work on. But please let us know what you think. At Overrun EMS is on Twitter. Overrun Productions on Facebook and Instagram. Leave comments in the show in the comments section on the website. We're on Apple Podcasts. Please rate, review, subscribe. Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify. We may be on iHeartRadio at this point. I'm not really quite sure. So check us out there.
Well, let us know if we are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Send
us a
line if you're getting this from some other place that we don't know about because we're putting it everywhere.
So, and also just like quick industry talk, Spotify and iHeartRadio do not tell you that you're on on their feeds. You just kind of have to find out. So if you're listening at it through a venue that we're not sure of, let us know. But let us know what you guys think. I think this is going to be a very interesting discussion. And I think it's something that people kind of think about maybe, but they don't address it as well as they should.
It's
a multifaceted problem with tons of issues that, you know, we're going to have to look at as an industry, as individual clinicians.
Yeah, I think it's an examination.
And we're going to have these discussions.
It's a topic I'm particularly passionate about too.
Yeah.
If you couldn't tell already.
No, absolutely.
I mean, if you were in here with us, you'd watch me be as Italian as my name implies and throwing my hands around and
he's actually tossing a pizza right now.
The bottom line is, as a clinician, do the right thing by your patient.
And I think in that case, where Ed had said that this is a close failure, I'm going to call this a failure right out.
And if you can't do that.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Anna.
You go ahead.
No, you.
Okay, well, then I'm going to say
fight,
that the failure.
Fight.
Yes. I'm going to go ahead and say that the failure actually lies in our educators. We are not stepping up to the plate when it comes to informing people when to remove emotion and when to place emotion.
Well, let's take it one step further. What's the big ethos in EMS? First, do no harm, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or maybe first, do not judge.
Yeah,
it's good
maybe
idea.
Do no harm.
And if you can't do that, folks, it's time to go do something else.
Yeah. Time to hang it up.
Listen,
go
nobody,
sell shoes, folks.
Let's just say that nobody gets paid so much in this job that you couldn't move on and do something else.
It's absolutely true.
If you can't muster the empathy for a human being, ask yourself the question.
That's a show for a whole other time.
We'll do that.
Believe
one.
Me, I am ready.
But again, over on podcast, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe. I'm Ed Bowder.
I'm Dan Schwester.
I'm Kevin Mazza.
I'm Anna Ryan.
Thanks for listening, and we will come back next week, and we'll talk to you then.
Get home safe.
Bye.